Hey guys, welcome to the Martial and Healing Arts channel. I'm Rafe Kelly, founder of Evolve Move Play. I'm extremely excited to be sponsoring this channel. Martial and Healing Arts have been key aspects of embodiment and self-cultivation for thousands of years. I have some of my best friends in the industry, Rory Miller, Matt Thornton, Edward Hines, presenting here, and I'm really excited to share what they have to say with you guys. You're gonna love it. So Evolve Move Play is an ecology of practices of movement, mindfulness, nature connection, and community. And within the movement, we have a big emphasis on moving in nature and being able to do parkour. We also like to lift weights and throw things around, but there's a huge aspect of martial arts, and I've been training martial arts since I was 6 years old. So it's really exciting to be able to sponsor this channel in particular. If you're interested in my work, check out my talks on the Main Stage and the Movement Anatomy channel. If you can't get to either of those live, you can check us out at Rafe Kelly on Instagram, get all your awesome embodiment giveaways. And for now, just enjoy this amazing channel. It's gonna be an awesome show.
Matt Thornton, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you here this evening, or this afternoon for you guys. One of the pioneers of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in the US, and the first to receive his black belt in Oregon State. Matt has a video series known as Aliveness, which was voted one of the top five self-defense videos of all time by Black Belt Magazine. On top of running his own academy located in Portland, Oregon for over 20 years, acting as head coach for SBG, coaching top level athletes and giving aliveness workshops around the world, Matt has also been published in multiple martial arts publications. The main emphasis of his work over the last decade has been addressing superstition as it relates to the fields of sports training, combat sports and martial arts. He's currently working on a book covering violence and its relationship to everyday life from the individual's perspective. So I'm very excited, and with no further ado, I shall hand over to you, Matt. Very much looking forward to what you have to say.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. When I was first asked to give this talk, I was thinking about, you know, the best subjects to talk about with the audience. And several times a year, I'll give a kind of a guest lecture at the university here in Portland State on skepticism in the martial arts. And there's a direct connection between skepticism and the way I think about martial arts, the way I think about everything, really. And so I thought that might be a good place to start with everybody today. And then I'm happy to field questions. Usually 90% of the time, the most interesting thing is always other people's questions. So I'd be happy to get to that. But when I initially started martial arts, I started martial arts because I was interested primarily in what works and what doesn't work in actual application in a real fight. So it wasn't I didn't start martial arts for a philosophical reason. I'd be lying if I said I started martial arts for self-improvement. I was attracted to martial arts from a very early age as a young boy, because I've been fascinated by the question, what works and what doesn't. And so my dad put me in a more traditional karate when I was a child. I didn't really mesh with that too well. And when I exited the military, I began training in what's known as Jeet Concepts, or JKD. And I gravitated towards that because I was boxing at the time, and they used boxing strikes. And for me, I'd come to a recognition that when you're talking about striking, boxers are pretty good. I mean, they get paid millions of dollars to be able to do what they do. So from the scientific perspective of striking, that was the direction I wanted to go. And I wanted to pursue boxing at the time. And I also knew from having been in some situations and some fights as a kid that you also needed to have some grappling, because you could be a good boxer, you could be a good striker, and then wind up on your back, or wind up with somebody sitting on your chest and having them punch you, which I certainly had to happen in school, or have them hold you in a headlock. So most of us that have ever been in any kind of fight when we were kids have probably experienced that kind of thing. And unfortunately, I didn't have a wrestling background. And so I knew I was missing that piece. And what the Jeet Kune Do community was preaching at the time, the rhetoric was about being able to fight at all ranges. That was one thing that Bruce Lee talked about, being able to fight at all ranges effectively. And then he borrowed a term, a very utilitarian term from Mao Zedong, a saying which was, absorb what is useful, reject what is useless, and add what is specifically your own, all of which appealed to me. So I sought out some Jeet Kune Do training. I found some instructors. I began training in that while at the same time boxing. And I was, at the time I was boxing 5 days a week, and ultimately became an instructor, moved to Portland, taught at a school with another instructor who was affiliated with Dan Anasano, who did the Muay Thai and the Kali and all that. And I'm giving you guys the condensed version because I want to get to your questions. But in a very short period of time, within a couple of years, I became very turned off by what I saw in that community, which was, to me, a lot of hypocrisy, where people would say one thing to a class about what works and what doesn't work, and say something completely different behind closed doors. And there were some things that were clearly functional, boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai, those were very obviously functional arts, and other things that were absolutely ridiculous in terms of functionality. And I did not see the instructors being honest about which was which. And I didn't find it healthy. And I also didn't think that that road would lead anywhere positive for me as a person or in general. And around that same time, I was fortunate enough to have an introduction to what we now know as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but at the time was Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, because one of Holes Gracie's and Hickson Gracie's black belts, early black belts, Fabio Santos, just happened to be living in Portland, Oregon. And this was prior to the UFC. And he wanted to get ready to train. Jorge and Gracie had sent him a message saying he should get back in shape because he's going to have some work for him coming up. And that was him preparing for what he knew would happen at the first UFC. And Fabio's way of getting in shape was to put an ad in a little local newspaper, because this is pre-internet really, and ask for people to come try and beat him up. He'd give you $50. And, you know, I talked to my friend, I was paying every month to get beat up at the boxing gym every day. So I'm like, hey, if somebody's going to pay me to get beat up, I'll go try it. Plus I'm curious. And the results were exactly what you'd expect, what you'd see in UFC 1. Fabio took me down, mounted me, and finished me pretty easy. And he's much smaller than I am. I'm a pretty big guy. At the time, I was a lot thinner, but I was still probably 190, 195, and 6'7", 6'8". Fabio was in his early 40s at the time, I believe. And I don't think he weighed more than probably 145, 150 pounds. And the moment we went to the ground, everything was very easy for him. On top of which, he was also just a really nice, good guy. So I immediately signed me up. I immediately started training with Fabio. I took a few lessons from him as much as I could. And he wound up moving to Southern California to help Horian prior to UFC. But that was my introduction to jiu-jitsu. And shortly after that, I ran into Hickson Gracie at a class where I watched him, what we call Ironmaning now, but where you wrestle one person after the other in a row and submit everyone without using his hands. So he just put his hands in his belt, just laid with his legs, and he would tap them out. And a good percentage of the people that were out lined up against the wall were judo black belts. And Hickson wasn't breaking a sweat. It was very easy for him. And I realized that this is what I've been looking for. This is truth in martial arts. It's not pretending to be able to do something, but actually being able to do it, which I think there's a great value in that level of authenticity and truth. So I immediately began training with Hickson, began training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and that was my start. Eventually came to heads with the other instructor that I was teaching at. We just had different directions. I had a different overall goal, and I opened up my first school here in 20 minutes south of here in a place called Kaiser, Oregon, in 92. And everybody told me at the time, all my friends in the Jeet Kune Do community told me that I wasn't going to make any money. Everybody wants to collect certificates. They want to click sticks together. They want to learn patterns. Nobody wants to sweat. Nobody wants to have to tap out. Nobody wants to get hit. You know, you're going to fail if you do it that way. And there was a lot of cynicism in that community, where even the people who knew better sometimes would be teaching what I call those fantasy-based martial arts for no other reason than money, because they felt if they transferred to functional systems, they would lose their student base. And whatever reason, I could not bring myself to do that. So I said, okay, I'm going to have a second job. I'll always have a second job, but I have to teach martial arts and pursue martial arts the way I think I should. And that means for me, that means truth. And so I started my own school. And long story short, obviously I wasn't alone. There was a ton of people that wanted to train the way I do. You can see that since then, there was no MMA schools or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu schools in Oregon at the time. But since then, you can go to more or less any major city in the world and you're going to find Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you're going to find mixed martial arts gyms, you're going to find the kinds of schools that I started back then. So, you know, I was not alone. There was a lot of people that were interested in training the way I did. Around that time, after I'd opened the school for a few years and I started to train with some of the UFC fighters like Randy Couture and some of the other guys who helped us bring in the clinch game, I put out a series of videos titled Aliveness. And aliveness was a one-word term, a meme, if you will, to explain why things work and don't work in martial arts, because that was a question I was obsessed with as a child. And it's a question that I would get all the time. And it's a question I'm sure many of you get or asked or see, where people ask, what about this art? What about that art? And they, you know, want to, what about Wing Chun or Taekwondo? And the piece I thought people were missing was, it's not about the specific art or which geographical location it comes from or how old it is or anything like that. It's about the training method. If they have a functional training method, they're going to be able to work. And all the martial arts that are functional, martial arts that work, all tend to have one thing in common, which is they're all also sports. So they have some level of realistic competition. So the arts, the delivery systems, which is a word I would prefer to use in the UFC, are going to be boxing and Muay Thai and Greco-Roman and Judo and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and folk style and freestyle wrestling and Sambo. So, you know, all these arts, they have, each has its own specific limitations in the rule set. But because they all use competition, there is a form of aliveness. And so what I wanted to get across to people is that once they understood what aliveness was, they would never, first of all, they'd never be bullshitted again by martial arts con artists. And second of all, they would know the answer to what works and what doesn't. They'd be able to see it immediately. And so aliveness is timing, energy, and motion. Three words, three different perspectives of really the same thing. So timing, I mean, it's not in a pattern. It's moving, it's alive, and so that you have to respond in real time. So in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, for example, we will practice headlock escapes. You're going to show the person the headlock escape. They're going to practice it for a few minutes to make sure they can do it mechanically correct. And then we start drilling. And when we drill in SBG, it's always alive. And so what's going to happen is the other person is going to really try and hold them down. And it doesn't always mean 100%. It doesn't mean full contact. And aliveness and sparring are not synonymous. But it does mean that they're going to be really trying to hold them down. It's not in a pattern. And we can adjust, move up and down the level of resistance to what's going to be functional and healthy for that particular person. But that's the first thing. Second thing is was timing. And because it's not in a pattern, what you start to do is you start to get timing. And this was an idea that really was hammered home to me by Hickson when he talked about the differences between black belts and white or blue belts in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You can have a purple belt that knows twice as many techniques as a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but the black belt will usually win every single time in a full-on grappling match because of the timing. And that timing you only get from dealing with a resistant opponent, resistant training partner on the mat. So the first thing is timing. Energy is that second piece. It's like realistic energy. We're not moving in a way that's contrived or would not resemble what an aggressive resisting person would resemble. And motion, again, it's live movement. So it's really just three words for essentially the same type of thing. And every martial art that's functional, every training method that's functional, if we're talking about martial applications, is going to involve aliveness. That doesn't mean full contact. It doesn't mean we just throw people in the water. So there's a lot of, you know, questions that come after that we can get into. But that was the initial revelation of what I wanted to try and get across the martial arts community. And so that was my first message. I put that out. And a lot of people saw that video and were thinking along the same lines as I was. So they responded back to me, and that became the beginning of what we now call SBG, which is now a worldwide organization. We have locations all over the world, including, you know, Ireland with John Kavanaugh and Conor McGregor, who's probably our most famous combat athlete right now, but Adam and Roy Singer in Georgia, who trained Forrest Griffin from the very beginning, from white belt on, and I'm going to stop here before I keep naming people. Chris Connolly, who's got a bunch of fighters now, but I'm going to stop because there's just so many world-class coaches and I'll forget somebody. But we've grown. We have a lot of competitive athletes, but 95% of the people who train in my gym here in Oregon or in the organization aren't training to become mixed martial arts fighters. Most of them are training because they want to do something that's healthy. They want to do something that's functional and they want to learn self-defense. And within the first couple of years of training, they start to feel comfortable with that self-defense aspect, which a couple of years of functional training and a live martial art, especially something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, will give you. And then people's motives sort of naturally, organically change to just the love of the art and, you know, Jiu-Jitsu versus Jiu-Jitsu, this kind of never-ending game that evolves forever. And that's beautiful, and that's the way it should be. But most of our students are everyday people. And so how does this fit into skepticism in the martial art? Well, essentially what I'm talking about when I'm talking about aliveness is I'm talking about an epistemology. And the competition itself is an epistemology drawn from the Latin root competere, which means to grow together. You have to have that opposing force to grow. And if you think about the scientific process, when it's done correctly, and it is a process, it's an epistemology, it's a tool set that we can use to arrive at objective answers about the world. When it's done correctly, it is itself a rigorous form of competition. You put forward a hypothesis, you have to test it, you have to try and make it fail. And then other people who are equally qualified in whatever field you're testing come in and try and shoot down your hypothesis. And only through that process and through resisting and withstanding that process, that inquiry, and that open and honest inquiry, do we grow? Our knowledge about the world starts to grow. And so the link between functional martial arts and the link between philosophy, the link between science really is aliveness. It's epistemology. It's the answer seeking method. So how you arrive at a particular conclusion is really what matters, not more than even the conclusion itself. So if you have a functional epistemology, then you can arrive at answers which better align with objective reality and can make your life better. And you can grow as a person and mature as a person. So that's the real connection, that scientific process. I have said a few times the word truth, which to me is very important. And oftentimes people want to unpack that, but to make it simple, I'd say we have two different kinds. We can have objective and subjective answers. If I said to the room, hey, I think there should be chairs in this room, and someone else says, well, I don't think there should be chairs, and they have cultural reasons or health reasons or whatever, we can have a argument back and forth, we can have a conversation. And in the realm of that question, we could both have our own points, and we could both have our own quote unquote truth, and we could both be right. That's a subjective question. If I say there's chairs in this room, and someone else says, oh, no, there's no chairs in this room, one of us is wrong. That's an objective question. And objective questions admit to ever-increasing complexity, ever-increasing understanding, and ever-increasing measurements. There's an objective measurement between the Earth and the Moon. The better we get at measuring it, the more complex and fine-tuned that measurement becomes, but it's an objective question. How far is the Moon from the Earth? And it admits to an objective answer. So I do think you have to come to martial arts or living or the world with at least that grounding. And if you have that, then everything after that is going to be built on honest answers, on not pretending to know things you don't know, on not pretending to do things you can't do. One of the great values of functional martial arts is they teach you not just what you can do, but also what you can't do, the realities of physical violence and confrontation, which I think is just as important, if not more important. Because the moment you start to pretend to know things you don't know, to make up answers on the fly, we basically stop the process of inquiry. We stop growing, we stop maturing. And so for me, that is the real key. I think our beliefs should be proportioned to the evidence. And in that sense, I think what's important is not faith or the will to believe, but rather the wish, the desire to find out. I'm interested in finding out the truth. I'm open to being wrong on any given particular issue. I'm open always to new evidence. And if you're holding a particular belief, I think it's important you ask yourself, you know, what could come forward that would have me change my mind? And if there's nothing that could come forward that would have you change your mind, it might be good for you to reevaluate that particular belief. But constantly thinking about what evidence could someone bring forward to change your particular opinion or belief in a particular area is very important. Being open to that evidence and having an open mind is not just believing that anything that somebody tells you is true, but being willing to observe other people's evidence. Having said all that, what I've discovered from having, this has been my only job for 25 years, and I've had the pleasure of traveling all over the world and teaching and watching people grow through the arts. And I've realized that underlying this, there's also, of course, real tangible benefits in terms of maturity and in terms of confidence and in terms of becoming a better human being in a way that to me is what matters, which is in your behavior and how you treat other people and your relationships. Because if there is anything in this world that I would be comfortable defining as spiritual, it's going to be found in my relationship to that world, and in particular, my relationship to other people. And so an ever increasing and growing level of empathy and impulse control and self-awareness is important. And I think the moment that we begin pretending to know things we don't know, or the moment we close ourselves off to more evidence, or the moment we stop asking ourselves questions, that process stops. That process of maturity stops. So the beautiful thing about functional martial arts is they really do have a tangible benefit in people's lives. I've seen kids come in that were autistic and had trouble even being able to look somebody in the eye. And 2 years later, they're literally teaching a class with confidence and they're feeling comfortable in their own body. They're able to move around. So
I'm going to interrupt 1 second, Matt. Mm-hmm. I love that. And I'm just, Brian Walsh is asking just while you're on that, what are examples of non-functional, unauthentic instructors?
Sure. So if I were to teach something, like, for example, a martial art that I think is relatively silly in terms of functionality would be Aikido. I could pick any number. I could pick version of Chinese Kung Fu, but I just prefer to be honest about this stuff. If you're teaching that and you say to the students in the room that this is a kind of a cultural artifact, that we're training it specifically as an art, we're learning to move, there's a cultural heritage to it, all that's fine. But the moment you tell people that this is something you're going to use for self-defense, then it better be something that can actually work for self-defense, especially you're going to give people the idea that they're going to be able to use it in a confrontation that could otherwise involve them getting badly hurt. And a lot of what is taught there is rather silly. And so what will happen in those kind of circumstances, if they see somebody like me, or they see a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu instructor or a boxer come in or something, whatever it is, combat athlete come in, they will tone down the rhetoric about what works and what doesn't work. And to me, they will say, well, we just mostly do this as a means of, not it's true, but it's useful. And so there's levels of how people will argue for pseudoscience. The first one is it's true. But once you get past that, they immediately go to, well, it's not true, but it's useful. And often like to play a kind of Mott and Bailey strategy where they switch back and forth between the two. When they talk to someone like me, they'll say, well, it's not true, it's useful. But the problem with that is the moment I turn around, then they talk to their audience or their students, then they go back to, well, that's actually true. An analogy from religion would be, if I'm talking to a fundamentalist Christian and in conversation with me or debate, they say, well, you know, it's really a metaphor and Exodus and the, and or when we talk about Genesis in the book of Noah and the watchers and the worldwide flood, that's a metaphor for, and then can insert whatever Jungian stuff you want. But then when I go and poll his congregation, you find that 85 to 90% of the people in that congregation treat Genesis as a news report and actually believe it to be real. It's because when I'm not there, when they're talking, they teach it as if it's a news report, not a metaphor. And so there is a hypocrisy that's there that I find is often there with make-believe, but I would just refer simply to as make-believe topics, because it has to be. Because if you truly open yourself up to evidence, you're gonna find out pretty quickly the world wasn't covered by by water 6,000 years ago. It just wasn't. And then you have to confront that reality, and that can lead to uncomfortable, difficult questions. So anyway, the connection between functional martial arts and the scientific process exists in that level of competition, that openness to evidence and the epistemology. Likewise, the connection between make-believe martial arts, whatever they are, and superstition is a direct correlation with what you find in religion. And the evidence that they will put forward is the same. It's anecdotal or it's an argument from authority. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Sorry, yes, I hope that answers Brian's question. That's great. Thank you for that, Matt. Lord Ramsbottom, I haven't forgotten you, but I'm just gonna ask another one that has come in from SBG Athens. And it says, aliveness is well understood by competitive sports athletes and within the combat arts like BJJ, wrestling and boxing. But why is there still such a prevalence of anti-aliveness in many, if not most, traditional martial arts?
Right, that's a good question. And I get asked that question a lot. Two things. I never was under the impression that talking about aliveness and explaining functional martial arts was going to mean that fantasy-based martial arts would disappear. I think there will always be a market for that. Just like I think the existence of the science of evolution has not made creationism disappear. I think there will always be a market for people who want to believe in a creator God. So I think ultimately it comes down to what people's motives are for training. If someone really is motivated to learn the truth about what works and what doesn't in a fight, they're interested in self-defense, or maybe they really are interested in more of a self-perfection aspect, but they want that to come from something authentic and something real, they will find their way to combat sports, ultimately. They will find their way to one of our schools, to SBG Athens or someplace like that. I have no doubt about that. And with the existence of the internet and everything, the work that we've done in SBG and the other work that people do, the UFC, there's all kinds of different things now. It's a much different world in 2020 from 1980 or 1970 in how people think about martial arts, and the volume of superstition that's out there has really been minimized. But that said, I don't think it's ever going to disappear. We still have astrology. So those kinds of things will be there for people who are looking for that. And if they're looking for that, if there's a marketplace for it, somebody's going to come in and fill that marketplace. But what's important to me is that the message is out there about what is real, and someone understands that there is such a thing as, for example, astronomy, and they can work their way towards a better and truer understanding of the nature of the universe. So that's basically the short answer, the short version of that speech that I give. And what I'll talk after that, I'll start to field questions. And the last point I would leave everybody with is for me, it's not about it, and it never has been about, well, this person's wrong or this person's right, or putting another art down, which people often worry about. But one thing I want to leave people with to understand is that in any field that where we care about the results, any place where you actually care about the results, whether it's your child gets sick and you need to take them to a doctor, or somebody's attacking from next door and we need to have the ability to defend it, or you need to be able to pay your rent next month, whatever it is, something where the results matter, human beings will turn to as functional a method as possible. And they will understand in the context of that, the moment it truly matters to them, that it's not enough to be well-intentioned. We also have to be right. And I think that's an important thing to remember, because it's so easy to get lost. And as long as you bring yourself back to that, no matter what the topic, whether we're talking about something as banal as martial arts or we're talking about medicine, it's important to always bring ourselves back to that. And within that context, for the people who are working within a field where it matters, whether we're talking about cancer research or medicine, those people have to be actively engaged in a constant, rigorous process of competition, because the results matter and we want to grow. And we grow on the knowledge of the people that came before us by learning that knowledge and then questioning that knowledge and then building on that knowledge. And so whether we're talking about building a bridge or testing for medicine or learning how to fight, it's really, really important that that scientific process is in play. And that the openness to questions and being questioned is vital. So if a scientist comes forward and gives a lecture in Oxford on some new version of evolution that he thinks is valuable or profound as it relates to human biology, he has to be open to a room full of qualified peers and students and everyone else submitting questions to him and questioning his hypothesis is not rude, and it's not it definitely can't be taboo, and it's not an insult. It's how we as humans grow. So when I talk about it, and I want to make sure everybody understands this before I just leave it off for questions. When I talk about martial arts, I talk about fantasy-based martial arts and functional martial arts. I talk in very plain terms because I'd just rather be honest with everybody and straightforward. And I don't see any reason behind or any value to sugarcoating my words. But I'm talking about systems. I'm talking about belief systems. I'm talking about ideas. I'm talking about training methods. I'm not talking about people. So we oftentimes become very attached to whatever belief it is. And then when somebody questions that belief, no matter what it is, whether it's a religious belief or a belief about a particular alternative medicine or whatever it is, someone begins questioning that belief, it can bring up some negative emotions in us where we feel like we're being attacked. I think it's very important to see that as a warning sign that maybe you do want to question that belief a little more and understand that the only thing that should ever shrink from inquiry are things that are false, as Thomas Paine often said. We want to pursue what's real, and we want to pursue what's true. And I believe strongly in my core, and have seen the evidence over the several decades, that that's also a very solid way for people to become better human beings. But yeah, I'm happy to field any questions anybody has.
So, thank you. We've got one from Lord Ramsbottom here, and he's asking, what do you think may be your next tangent in your jiu-jitsu and life studies, the area you haven't had a chance to explore, but you know you will?
That's a good question. So I started writing a book, I almost hate to say, admit this, but it was about 6 years ago. It was a book on violence. And I spent the first 2 years in research and read lots and lots of material. And then I realized at a certain point, the research can go on forever and you actually have to start writing. So I stopped, but I wanted to know everything that was on the market to make sure that what I had to say hadn't been said before and if somebody had said it better. And then I began the process of writing, and now I'm done and I have an agent. That book is floating out in the marketplace to be picked up here at some point. So that will come out. And that is specifically on violence. Violence as it relates to individual human beings, the effect it can have on you, self-defense, practical self-defense, and much of the epistemology I talked about here today, but also the broader implications of that on an individual level. I am happy now that book is done. And hopefully that gets picked up here soon. I'm sure I'll have to do a lot of interviews and talks and stuff about that book. But then to be honest with you, I would love to move on to a completely different topic, totally unrelated to violence. And I have no idea what that is, but I love playing Dungeons and Dragons with my kids, for example, and we have a lot of adult games. I could very well see myself just writing an adventure story for that or something completely different.
That's great. Actually, it's nice you bring up kids because I've got one. Thank you, Lord Ramsbottom, for that question. I've got one question here from Shane Nicholson asking about suggestions for older athletes, i.e. 51 years old, training BJJ, and also brings up a question for me around the kids side of things. But if you want to go for the older training first, that would be great.
Good. Those are great questions. So I'm 51. Here's the thing. So first of all, I'll address a fairly common superstition that comes up in martial arts where they will say, well, you know, those arts are for young people and athletes. But when you get older, you need to defend yourself. You need to use, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, when you get older, you have to use Tai Chi or insert something else there. And the first thing I would just say to everybody is, listen, if there's a way that works to fight really well for a young 22 or 23 year old, and that's the best way you can possibly find to solve this problem. So problems like, going back to what I talked about before, problems like how to escape a headlock, those are objective questions. Those aren't subjective questions. Those are questions like, should we or should we not have a chair in the room? They will admit to better answers. There are good, better, best answers, best practices to how you escape a headlock. Now, the best practice for how you escape a headlock, which I feel is something that we have pretty well sorted out, for example, in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, if that's the best practice for a 22-year-old, it's going to 100% be the best practice for a 51-year-old. The reality of it is it's just going to be harder because they're going to be younger, probably in better shape, potentially stronger, less prone to injury. And that is the reality of life. So twofold. One is just to understand that. So if somebody's giving the answer, well, this is for an old person martial art. Let me tell you something. If there was a secret way old people could fight and beat up young people would do it too. Okay? So they would do it. But that's the first piece to understand. The second piece to understand is that journey. So I've been rolling in wrestling and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu sparring in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu since I started in my early to mid-20s. And now I'm 51. It's much harder now. And when I go on the mat and I roll with one of my younger black belts, I'm going to have to face the reality that they're going to submit me. And I can do two things. I can then avoid them and stop rolling with them because I don't want to get submitted. At which point my level of maturity and growth will have capped to a certain degree by my own choice, my own ego, to not confront that part of my journey. Or I can say, you know what? Yeah, he's 23. He learned from me. Of course he should tap me out. If I can't create 23-year-olds that can tap me out, I can't create world champions because I can't go compete in a world championship right now. I'm way too old. So what's that say about me as a coach? So I have to get back on the mat. I'd be willing to go through that whole process and not all of a sudden become a street guy who no longer trains with his athletes because I'm 51. So that's the second thing. The reality of having to face that journey and becoming an older athlete is a valuable one. I think as human beings and for our ego that all of us should go through and not avoid. And the last piece, the practical piece I would give you is, yes, you're going to have to train in the same way and that we did when we're 21. We just have to be more careful. So you have to be smart. So if you get hurt, it's obviously counterproductive. I want to be able to roll and train all my life. So things that I have to do now at 51 are things that I should have done when I was 22 or 23, but completely avoided, like maintaining my warm up and cool down, and which I still don't do very well. But you know, my exercise and the limited amount of weight training that I do is very important now at this age, that I don't skip that because I know that my body's far less prone to being injured as long as I maintain that level of strength training. So, and I pick my partners. You know, yes, I'm not going to avoid my young black belts, but to be honest with you, those are the men and women who are the safest for me to roll with because I know I'm not going to get hurt. Whereas if I go with a really big, strong white belt that came in off the street like I would when I was 25, yes, ultimately, I'm for sure going to win that competition. But at the end of the day, if my neck's all messed up and my back's messed up because this person has no control over their body, what did I really win, right? And then I can't train for 2 weeks. So you have to be smart about your exercise and your diet and do things that you didn't maybe have to do when you were younger, and be smart about who you train with. And the more in jiu-jitsu, the awesome part is the better that person is technically, the safer they're going to be to train with.
Awesome. Thank you. I hope that answers the question, Shane. Just on a personal note, actually, because I've got two girls aged 6 and 9.
Same as me.
Great. So you're the right person to ask exactly at this moment then, because they've done a dipped their toe in a little bit of Wing Chun when we were in the UK, and now we're in Germany. They're doing Taekwondo, and obviously I'm not in the room with them, especially at the moment with all the COVID restrictions and everything. So it's just wondering how you really feel, or how, you know, what kind of questions I could ask them as to the aliveness in their sessions, and how I really understand whether, you know, is this the right place for them? One, is it the right martial arts? But as you said, maybe that's not so important right now and they can choose later at some point. But really just to to understand how you, how I as a parent could understand that they're getting that aliveness that you talk about, the timing, energy, and motion.
Sure. So some of what we're going to, I'm going to give you the best answer I can, but we'll have to couch it in terms of COVID, because that kind of really changes everything, right? Because now they may not have that person-to-person contact. But, you know, that's going to be for a limited time. So let's talk about after that's over, what they can do in regular time. As a father of two daughters, the same age as your daughters, what's really important to me in terms of self-defense is that they are not taken aback when somebody comes over and puts their hands on them and tries to shake them or grab them or pull them in a car or move them around or impose themselves past their boundaries. It's very important to me that the girls understand that it's not just okay to defend your boundaries. They will be supported and affirmed for, so I want them to have very firm boundaries. And I want them to be comfortable with physicality. So if I have to choose between a martial art that I think is not necessarily a functional martial art, or rugby, or wrestling, or something physical where they're going to feel the contact of another girl or another boy who's really trying to grab them or take them down, I'm going to choose rugby or football or something like that. Because what's important for me, for them as young girls and boys, but is that they become comfortable with that physicality. And you can't get that physicality from make-believe martial arts, generally speaking, because they don't do it. Yeah. Next to that, then we get into the physical aspects, and whether my child wanted to do boxing or Muay Thai or wrestling or jiu-jitsu, I'd be okay with all of it. The one thing I would say is we do know from, there's more than enough scientific research to know that boxing causes brain damage. So you can train boxing and you can train Muay Thai on the mitts and you can train it with a really good coach who knows what they're doing, but I don't really want my kids boxing. I don't want them going in a ring and doing amateur boxing, even to the really limited degree that I did. I don't want them doing that. So the beautiful thing, I'm going to be doing another sales pitch here really for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, but the beautiful thing about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is of all the functional martial arts, it's the one that's the least damaging to your body. You don't have to get brain damage to get good at it. You don't have to get slammed over and over again on the mat to get good at it. You can train in a fairly gentle way and still become effective. And, you know, I don't want to give a firm number because I'll forget somebody, but I have at least four or five female black belts. One of my black belts, she is in her mid-60s now. She began training with me when she was 51, and she's tiny. She's 109 pounds or something. She can defend herself. You can get a young man coming to the gym and try and hold her down or try and put her in a headlock or something. She will submit them. She will put them in a position where they actually physically tap out, or they will go unconscious or get their arm broken, because she's a legit black belt. And she earned that through those years of training. And that's priceless. It's not pretending that they got submitted. They're not going along with it. She can impose her will on them if she wants to. And so that is the power of jiu-jitsu. That's the power of a functional martial art. So I also want my girls to have that. The tricky part is I don't want them to not enjoy it because I'm pushing them into it. So the more you can make it a game, the more to me, what's really important from like the, I think they should be training from four on, but from the age four to teenage years, all I really care about is that they have a blast, that they're really enjoying training, they're coming in and they're getting the value. And along with that, they're getting that physicality that we talked about, they're getting the push and pull. And somebody comes over and grabs them and puts their hands on them, they're not gonna be thrown off by that. It's like, oh, they're used to feeling that. So they get both those things. And so I would try and find a class and let your girls try the class and make sure that they like come back and like, man, mom, I really wanna go back to that class. And then that's the place you wanna take them.
Okay. Love it. Yeah. Thank you. So we've got one more question from Adam Singer, who says he watches a lot of martial arts clips on social media. And he says, how can people learn to judge what is alive and what is bullshit when watching video clips?
It's a good question. It's not as hard as you would think. So here's my advice. Don't watch the person that's the technique. Watch the person they're doing it to. Watch the feeder, not the demonstrator. So whenever you see a fake martial art, you will see the same thing. Somebody's going to come in, for example, and throw a punch, and then they just stop. They just freeze in time, what Bruce Lee called dissecting a corpse. And then the other person does something that looks super cool. It could look very functional, or even better than functional. It could look like John Wick, because it's choreographed, and you can make anybody look cool with choreography. But what is the person doing that's doing that? Did they just let them throw them? Are they just standing there frozen with their arm locked out? Because no one in the world is ever going to attack you that way. You know, in Aikido, a very common thing would be like a big lunging step forward and try and chop somebody in the top of the head. And then when the Aikido person does the wrist lock or the throw or whatever it is, they will tumble and roll and fall. But they're not really trying not to get thrown. It's not like when you watch wrestling or judo, for that matter. If you watch Olympic level judo, you're watching two people who know what they're doing try and throw each other and not get thrown at the same time. It is a combat. It is a mutual combat between two skilled people. And in that sense, it is very different. And you can tell the difference, again, by watching not the person doing the demonstration, because the person doing the demonstration can always look cool. Watch the person that's feeding them. Watch the uki.
Hope that answers your question, Adam. Thank you. Okay, at the moment we have no more questions open. So if anyone else has a question for Matt, then please feel free to put it in the Q&A, or if you've got any comments on anything he said. Is there anything else that you wanted to add right now, Matt?
No, I think we got a chance to cover that. If people have more questions, they can look me up on the internet. We have the link you're going to put up, SBG University, and then my own blog, mattthornton.org. I have articles and things that I've written over the last 20 years that go into much more detail on all the things that I talked about. So if people have more questions, they can reference that.
Brilliant. I love I think what I'm taking away from this right now is not pretending to know things you don't know, and to kind of working out other people who are pretending to know things they don't know. It's yes. A little nugget for me. Okay, if anyone else has got any questions, please. We've got someone come into the Q&A now. Hang on, give me one second. So have you seen an increase, also from Shane, in BJJ interest in Portland with all the issues happening at the moment?
Yes and no. So we're right now still in a kind of a modified lockdown. So we're at what we call phase one. So there's not, people are training together, but they're training with their quarantine partner. So, you know, their wife or sister or whoever. We're not able to have regular Brazilian jiu-jitsu class right now because of the COVID restrictions. So hopefully that will, depending on what happens with that will change soon. I am getting a massive increase in the amount of calls of people who are asking for self-defense, and it's almost impossible to buy a gun or ammo in Portland right now, or much of the country, because so many people have purchased guns. So 40% of the new gun ownership over the last 45 to 60 days has gone nationwide to new gun owners, which is very rare. Most of the time, gun people buy lots of guns, and the one guy had 10 guns, but now we have a lot of people who've never owned a gun before, almost as many buying guns. And my own personal anecdotal experience, I've had half a dozen friends who, you know, would normally never want a gun or ask about guns, aren't gun people, quote unquote, who've asked me advice or asked my brother advice in the last couple months about purchasing firearms and training with firearms. In fact, I have one of my black belts who's really, really good trainer with firearms coming into the gym next month to do some training for people, because I will say this for anybody that's listening to me and is thinking about that and thinking about purchasing a gun. Number one, buy a safe first that's drilled into your floor, because you don't want to be one of those people that has their house burglarized and then you have another gun floating in the street, and you don't want kids from next door coming over and shooting themselves. So make sure you have your safe first before you purchase the gun. And then number two, get some training. Guns are not magic wands. You can't shoot people in the leg to stop them. There's a lot of bullshit as it relates to guns, just as much as there is martial arts. So find somebody who knows what they're talking about when it comes to guns, and put time. It's just a tool. but you have to put time in with that tool just like you would anything else to become proficient with it. And there's a lot of responsibility that comes with a gun. So that responsibility should involve you actually taking the time to get some training.
Yes, great, thank you. Deodara is asking, do you feel there is benefit in taking a weekend self-defense seminar for people who otherwise have no training? Would they get enough muscle memory in those techniques over a short period of time?
Good question. Yes and no. So it depends. Obviously it totally depends on the nature of the class, but we do seminars like that. And the major benefit from a seminar like that isn't going to be the physical training. You're realistically not going to get much from training 2 days. Even if all 2 days were purely physical, you just wouldn't. You do need to become skilled in jujitsu or boxing or wrestling. It does take time. But the real value is the information. So there's a lot of misconceptions around self-defense, a lot of misconceptions around violence, around who you're training for, who the attackers most likely are. For the vast majority of people, for example, the vast majority of people that become victims of violence are victims of people that they know. This is true of both men and women. About half of all homicides with women, it's their husband. And having said that, it's more dangerous to be dating than it is to be married. But it's almost always going to be a date. It's almost always going to be someone you know. And what happens with real incidents of violence is for the person that the victim of it, they will often say, oh, it happened so quickly. I was overwhelmed, which I'm sure is how they felt at the time. But if you ask them the right questions and you rewind the tape a little bit, in almost every single case, and by almost every single case, I'm talking about 99.99, we're talking about the massive percentage. There was a series of incidents that led up to that violent confrontation that went either unnoticed or intentionally ignored by people who don't want to confront the reality of the fact that you have a predator who's assessing you right now to see if they're going to attack you. And so coming in for a class like that, if the instructor does know what they're talking about and they're able to talk to people about that kind of information, I find that can be really useful because you might discover some things that you didn't otherwise know. And one of the main ones, and it's very simple, and for that questioner, if she's looking or he's looking for a good book, I would recommend right now until my book comes out, The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. But that is by far, in my opinion, the best book on self-defense that's ever been written. But his hypothesis is very simple. We're evolved primates, and we have, all of us, men and women, great instincts for when there's a predator in our midst who's trying to assess us. We all do. And we will feel those instincts. And ultimately, those instincts will manifest as fear, which is not worry or paranoia, but actual fear. Actual fear isn't something you can fake. It's real. It's a real thing. It comes on you because of something within your from your nervous system that's within range. And when those feelings come, this goes back to what I was talking about with my daughters, it's really important you don't ignore them. You don't ignore them because you want to be nice. You don't ignore them because you want to be polite. You know, and this is what often happens sometimes, is people want to be polite, they want to be nice. They've never confronted or been around the type of human beings who truly don't care about your personal well-being and would just as gladly kill you for $10. They just don't care. That kind of person, that kind of human is so foreign to them that it's kind of shocking. And then they ignore their own instincts until it really does become a physical confrontation. So teaching people to recognize those warning signs, those pre-incident indicators on their own biology, just to listen to what your own biology is telling you about. My girls understand if someone's giving them the creeps, that's all it takes. They don't need a better reason than that. I was giving a talk, not to go on a tangent real quick, but I was giving a self-defense talk actually in a pub one day. And my wife and daughter, she was 7 at the time, Annika, was sitting with my wife. And a guy came, it's a stranger, he came and sat next to my wife and daughter. And he was next to my daughter. And at some point in the talk, he put his hand on her shoulder, I think it was, or something like that. I kind of saw it, and to me it looked somewhat innocuous. I don't think it was anything creepy. But she immediately shrugged, and made it clear she didn't want that. And then my wife looked at him and stop completely. But my wife, both at the time and after, and I both praised her for that. Because the worst thing you can do in that situation is tell her she did something wrong. This is especially true if it's a relative, because when we're talking about the sexual abuse of kids, it's almost always a relative or mom's boyfriend. And it's really important to let children know that it's okay. And not only is it okay, that was great. That was a great response. There's no reason to put his hand on you. He's not your friend. So nurturing those instincts in girls and boys, I think, is really important. And if she gets that, or they get that from that self-defense seminar, then I think it could be really valuable.
I 100% agree. Yeah, thank you for that, Matt. That's great. Well, I'm afraid we're running out of time. That's been really informative. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. If you guys in the audience out there would like to continue the discussion, you can join the Facebook group or one of the coffee break sessions that Alina has put on the chat, where you can connect with other participants, keep these questions coming. Thank you once again to our channel sponsor for making all of this possible. And if you enjoyed this session as much as I did and you want to go back and listen to it again, you can access this recording for another 48 hours for free. And if you want to take full advantage of the discount that's running at the moment, you can buy the full library of recordings to digest everything in your own time, because there's so much richness just in this conversation and also in the whole of the Embodiment Conference series that we've been seeing over the last few days. So if you do buy the sessions and the library, you'll also receive notes, a learning list, so you get to work through it in a bit more of a logical way, and you also get just the audio if you like listening to it in the car like I do when I've dropped the kids off. Yeah, I think with that, the next session on this channel is in 1 hour. It's presented by Samuel Bonder, and it's focusing on whole body being healing and the one great heart we all share. Thank you all so much for being in this session with us today and for all your questions. It was a pleasure to be hosting with you, Matt. I've really enjoyed it and it's been really informative. And I'd just hand over to you for the last minute, just to give us your top tip, because I love that thing you just said about the kids and really feeling into your body. And so your top tip for, tapping into that embodiment and that sense of, feeling what's right or wrong, or whatever is your top tip for the embodiment for us today?
I would say get out and do something physical. Learn to trust yourself, learn to trust your body, learn to listen to your body. And the more you get outside and do something physical, the better that's going to be. And after that, go start a class of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
It's on the list. Thank you so very much. It was a real pleasure. And thank you to everyone. Enjoy the rest of the conference. And hope to see you again soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much.